Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Today's guest, Charles Barber, comments in the foreword of his book, Comfortably Numb, that in a 10-year period, he noticed that psychiatric drugs went from being an exotic rarity reserved for severely impaired homeless people to the latest hip thing. Suddenly, in the 1990s, psychiatric diagnoses and drugs became the new designer commodity, and people became fascinated by something 10 years before they abhorred. Designer drugs, designer diagnoses. How did our states of mind get so cosmetic so fast? The tragedy is that drugs don't work mostly, and this culture's reliance on them distracts us from real solutions that do work. And worse is the way that people that need societal support are being medicated instead. Join us this hour as we reveal real-life solutions for life's more painful conundrums. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. We're surrounded by health risks. Each day we make choices to avoid those risks, at least the ones we know about. Doing that could turn into a full-time job. Because time is scarce, we often use our intuition and rules of thumb. Some common strategies include following the recommendations of friends and family, health professionals, and people identified as health experts. On your own, you draw your own conclusions from reports in the media, any journals you might read, and the promotional materials for products and services. This is tricky business. An ocean of information exists on risks. Yet another ocean exists on what to do about those risks. How do you sift through it? Would you want to? So I was pleased to see that researchers at the Veterans Administration created a risk chart and published it in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. It sounded like a good idea. Use a consistent method to compare the risk of dying from the top dozen causes and organize them by age, sex, and smoking status. In a separate editorial, the important issue of how best to communicate this kind of science to civilians was discussed. But it was all very disappointing. As I read the article and examined the risk chart, I realized two things. First, it wasn't about risks, but about what you're likely to die from. Second, it was about dying, not suffering. Although it is of interest to know that, for example, if you're a man, you're more likely to die in an accident than from prostate cancer. It's also of interest that dying of the flu doesn't even register as a likely cause of death, something to keep in mind when hysteria over getting vaccinated breaks out in the fall. The big news, although it shouldn't be news at all, is that being a smoker makes it much more likely that you'll die of a heart attack, stroke, lung cancer, pneumonia, emphysema, or chronic bronchitis. So stop smoking. It's bad for you. What I discovered as I read this research was that I didn't want to know what I was likely to die from, but how I could avoid suffering until I die of whatever I'm going to die from. On the face of it, that seems an easy thing to do, what with the current focus on prevention in health science. But the study's risk chart casts doubt on this, too. Despite decades of spending on research and treatment, there are two things you're most likely to die from, hands down, a heart attack and cancer. In large part, this failure is the result of research on treatment rather than actual prevention. But we certainly know enough to know that environmental exposures, for example, are a principal cause of both heart disease and cancer. So don't expose yourself to environmental pollutants. It's bad for you. Nevertheless, what I want to know isn't what I'm likely to die from. I can look at my family history and make a pretty good guess. I want to know what puts me at risk of suffering. For example, I like to see a risk chart that compares suffering from treatments using pharmaceuticals to treatments using nutrients, or a risk chart for cancer therapy that compares the standard cut, burn, and poison strategy to non-invasive therapies. Better yet, I'd like to see a risk chart about chronic diseases that compares the risks from different ways of life, where you live, and how you live. It seems to me unlikely that such a chart will ever exist. But I think we make those kinds of choices every day. Sometimes we carefully examine evidence. More often we use our intuition and some serviceable rules of thumb. I'd like to recommend one. Do the simplest thing first. Simplest doesn't always mean easiest, of course. It means simplest for your body, what your body understands well. That's why compassion and nutrients are better than pharmaceuticals at reducing your risk of suffering. A transcript of this editorial is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is director of the Sustainable Health Institute at sustainablehealthinstitute.org. And now to our guest and our topic, Recovery Without Pharmaceuticals, Charles Barber, who is the author of Comfortably Numb, was educated at Harvard and Columbia and worked for 10 years in New York City shelters for the homeless mentally ill. The title essay in his first book, Songs from the Black Chair, won a 2006 Pushcart Prize. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Scientific American Mind, and other publications, and on NPR. He's a lecturer in psychiatry at Yale University School of Medicine and lives in Connecticut with his family. So we're very honored that you could join us today.
Oh, thanks very much. Great to be here.
Thank you. It is amazing how quickly Big Pharma insinuated psychiatric drugs into this culture. Do you want to comment?
Yeah, you know, I begin the book, you mentioned it in your intro, with a prologue that's called So Hip, So Quickly. And I relay my experience where I started in the late 80s working with the homeless mentally ill in New York. I worked in shelters. And I would go talk to my friends or friends of my parents, and I come from a pretty, white bread sort of background. And people didn't really understand what I was doing, why I was doing it. They didn't understand, maybe they'd heard of schizophrenia, maybe they'd heard of Thorazine, but they didn't have any deeper understanding of mental illness, and certainly not of the medications. It was just sort of those zombie meds. And about 10 years later, by the end of the 90s, the beginning of the 2000s, I talked to these same folks, and they were very appreciative of what I did. They thought it was great. There was now a name for my field. There hadn't been one before. It used to take me about 2 minutes to describe what I did. And now I worked in the field of mental health. And in addition, people were taking a lot of the same meds my clients were. And they'd sort of ask me for advice on certain medications, or they'd ask about their child who was bipolar or that kind of stuff. And that's really the impetus of the book. It's like, well, how did this happen so quickly? What went on here?
It's interesting to note that in Japan, the pharmaceutical companies were having a heck of a time figuring out how to insinuate or influence the culture enough to get people to be interested in this. They just didn't have even expressions in their language to cover this. And so they invented these new expressions and moved it into the culture.
Exactly. The marketers for the drugs invented this expression. I think in Japanese it's kokoro no kaze, which means cold of the soul. Because there wasn't a regular term for depression, and there wasn't the SSRIs, the Prozacs and Paxils and Zolofts, weren't available in Japan until 1999 when they began this marketing campaign, which was incredibly successful. And, I write a little bit about cultural stuff, and in Japan, depression or sadness, everyday sadness, but what I argue in the book we might call depression and be very quick to diagnose and medicate it, in Japan, wasn't sadness or mild depression wasn't considered to be a bad thing. It was considered part of life, part of the reality of the world, and even a sign of kind of sensitivity and artistic awareness. And so I think a lot of what's going on, these huge rates of antidepressant usage, and is this American phenomenon where we're, terribly quick to assign a diagnosis and not sort of look at the broader context and not look at, other ways of looking at suffering or emotional difficulty.
It strikes me that it's a lot like cosmetic surgery. It's like you don't have to suffer. You don't have to age. You don't have to suffer. There's a solution. We have a way to stop this.
Exactly. It's a guy called Carl Elliott, who's a bioethicist and a doctor at the University of Minnesota, who would be a very good guest for your show, wrote a book called Better Than Well, and came out about 4 years ago. And he writes about these kind of medical enhancement technologies, from Botox to steroids to plastic surgery to antidepressants. And, of course, there was a famous passage and a famous concept introduced in Peter Kramer's book, Listening to Prozac, which came out in 93 or 94, where the idea of cosmetic psychopharmacology, that the notion that he raises is that if you're a car salesman, Prozac might help you sell more cars. I reread that book in the research for my book and found it to be incredibly dated, because people don't really, I mean, they are using Prozac in that same way, but that sort of gee whiz quality, like, oh, let's, you know, we can sell more cars with this, that has really been lost. At the same time, the utilization figures for antidepressants just continue to go up, astonishing numbers, 230 million prescriptions written in 2007 in the United States. What really shocked me about that number, because I was aware of the high rates, was that it had actually gone up in the last few years. And in 2004, there was a black box warning for antidepressants, that they were associated with marginally increased suicidal thinking for young people. But that really sent what looked to be a shockwave through the industry. But the numbers just have continued to go up in the last few years.
One of the things that I always talk about that I think is sad about our culture is that if you allow yourself to have your life and your aging process, for instance, you actually can tell how you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't allow yourself to have those changes and those ups and downs, you actually don't know how you're doing. I mean, this medicalization, as we describe it on the show a lot, of symptoms prevents people from having any kind of comfortable dialogue with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So your title, Comfortably Numb, is very accurate, I think.
Yes, and, you know, we, as Americans, you know, it's sort of, I call it emotional sanitation in the book, you
That's
know,
good.
And I've been very active with promoting the book and traveling and doing interviews, and I'm very happy to do this interview because it's going to be more probing than a lot of the interviews that I've done. But remember, I did a reading in Cambridge, Mass, which must be the sister city of Berkeley, and a woman who was from Sweden said, you know, in Sweden, if someone asks you how you're doing, you say, oh, okay, you know, all right, things are okay, and then people are actually fairly happy. In America, you ask people how they're doing, it's great, wonderful, you know, have a nice day, the smiley face, and then we're apparently all pretty miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this kind of pressure to put the happy face on, or to pretend that everything is okay, or to very much look for these lifestyle enhancement medication interventions, probably the most dubious of which is, you know, Viagra. And meanwhile, not to look at, you know, the underlying issues that drive a lot of this depression and anxiety.
Yeah, the body actually usually does things for a reason.
Right.
So when you have something that feels like a symptom to you, it actually is, it's in place to have a dialogue with you and for you to pay attention to it, you know, i.e. pain. Not that,
right.
You know, not that people in chronic pain should experience pain all the time, but, you know, it's trying to tell you something. So that's the first step, is to find out what the roots are, and we've kind of lost that.
Right, right. And often, you know, with this rampant medicalization, it's a relationship problem. It's a
yes.
job problem. It's a financial problem. It's a divorce. You know, I've talked to people. You know, the doctor says, you look depressed, why don't you take antidepressants? Or you're under financial stress, why don't you take antidepressants?
Or you're going through menopause, why don't you go? Or
right.
you're a teenager or a young adult and you're having some transition problems. The other problem, which is the very, very dark side of doing this, isn't just that you're comfortably numb, but also that these medications have actions that are referred to as side effects, but they're not side effects. They are the effects. So while you may chemically lobotomize your brain, which is essentially what you're doing, you may also be damaging your brain, which is what the work of Peter Bregin, Bregin, points out, since he's been allowed to dive around in the files of the pharmaceutical companies and he's read the inside studies and things. So he knows that they know that, in fact, these drugs damage the brain. That's how the action is, that you can't, it's forcing the brain to do something. So, you know, I'd like you to talk a little bit about what you saw in the population that you worked with and how, you know, what you saw that impressed you to write this book.
Right. Well, what I worked with people primarily with schizophrenia and also bipolar disorder and major depression, personality disorders, but, you know, severe incapacitating illnesses. And I probably philosophically disagree with you a little bit that I found that the medications could be quite effective for, you know, a good portion of people. Just anecdotally, I'd say for schizophrenia and antipsychotics, where the efficacy is decent, 20% it does nothing at all. There's a middle range of people that it certainly helps, and then there's about 20% where it really helps. It really, you know, people talk about the voices that are so common in schizophrenia, just the volume lowering. But having said all that, there's, as you say, tremendous side effects, you know, weight gain, you know, negative symptoms, a flatness of affect, and then very specific, you know, sexual side effects, or, you know, for lithium, potential toxicity, or, you know, people not being able to go out to the sun, and on and on and on. But the main point is, even with people with severe conditions, I found that social approaches were absolutely critical, and in most cases more critical. So what I ran, after a while, housing programs, which were very nice apartment buildings for formerly homeless people. And the quality of the support, the quality of food, the quality of relationships, seeing people get reengaged back with their families, how you talk to people, how you understood their culture. So here's a specific example. We hired somebody, a guy who chronically heard voices to kill himself, and the devil and Jesus telling him things, and he grew up in a very religious and was very religious. And we hired some sort of brand new social worker who was very medical model, and she'd say, "What are your command auditory hallucinations going on? You know, what's going on?" And as soon as he said something that, you know, sounds like potentially risky, she would sort of segregate him and monitor him. And he would get worse, and he'd actually start hitting himself, which is what he would start to do when he was really perturbed. And what we would do, I was running the house, and when I say we, with people who were more experienced with sort of his context, is we would say, okay, you know, it's the voices again. You know, we know how to, let's sit back. And he would, listening to salsa music was the thing that really helped him. So when the voices happened, we'd say, okay, let's go upstairs, smoke a cigar. He was really into cigars. And let's listen to salsa music. And 90% of the time, it would not elevate to this sort of, you know, emergency degree. But when you approached it purely as a symptom, but without a social context, you know, you'd aggravate things. And so I found understanding the social context in which people were distressed, and also, because one of the things that's odd about psychosis, it actually makes a lot of sense once you get to know the person.
Right. That's my point.
Right. You know, if you look at the psychotic beliefs, they're grounded in reality. Like, you know, I worked with a guy who's a subject of a chapter in my first book, which is a memoir of my own history and also my work with homeless folks. And he would have sort of manic psychotic events where he thought, that what he did in America had tremendous impact on everybody, that every subsequent immigrant to America. And what happened was, when I got to know his own story, was he had come from Czechoslovakia in 68, and he was sort of part of the Prague Spring Revolution. And he was a capitalist, and he actually went to NYU Business School in America. And the idea was that he would be the first to come over, and then he'd establish himself and be a big success, which he was for a while. He was extremely successful. And then all his friends and family would follow. And then what happened is he had a tremendous psychotic break a few years later. And so this idea that appeared to be psychotic, that what his issues, you know, would punish the thousands of people that were to follow, you know, was based on a reality of expectation. And that's the sense that you get all the time when you talk to people and you probe deeper. And so understanding that sort of humanizes the, you know, these, what we would think of and are, you know, medical symptoms, but there's a broader context in looking at people. And then how you talk to people and how you address them can be enormously palliative in you know, their recovery.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we're on the phone with Charles Barber, author of Comfortably Numb, How Psychiatry is Medicating a Nation. This is a good segue to talking about a couple of different therapeutic styles that mm-hmm. you found particularly effective. And what I noticed in the book was confirmation of something that I've heard from other people who have worked with people who have psychotic, so-called psychotic episodes, which is that they do respond to therapy, that they don't only respond to medication, that they do respond, even schizophrenics respond to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So we have these two styles of patient-centered therapy. One is called stages of change, which we've talked about actually on the show in the context of people recovering from drug abuse and other substance problems. And then motivational interviewing and peer engagement. So I'd like you to sort of take off and describe those methods.
Right. Well, the stages of change model was introduced in the late 80s, early 90s. And essentially, you know, people like me anyway used to think of change as, and certainly the medicine establishment, as, you know, a linear process. And the insight, there are a couple of insights. It was conceived of as a cycle. And so for any change that we are thinking about, whether it's the guy who invented it was trying to develop it for getting off smoking, and actually he was trying to quit smoking when he developed it. But, you know, it could be weight change, it could be dealing with depression or anxiety or gambling problem, and it's most been applied to addictions, as you say. But that there's a pre-contemplation stage. That's when, you know, you don't think you have a problem, you're not going to do anything about it. There's contemplation, you think you have a problem, but you're just thinking about doing something, you're not doing anything. And then a series of action stages when you start to engage in actually changing the behavior and addressing. And then it's a cycle, and one either relapses and starts the cycle over again, or after 6 months of really controlling the behavior, you know, exits the problem. So the other insight was that relapse is part of recovery, and this is most pointedly in the addictions field, where it used to be considered, you know, you're either motivated or you're not, and if you're not, you know, I can't work with you, get out of my clinic. And a much more realistic understanding is relapse does not mean that people aren't motivated. It means that it's a realistic part of the process, and the point is to get back on the cycle of change. And then
let me just say one quick thing, which is that another thing you didn't mention that stages of change apply to is when people are diagnosed with some kind of potentially chronic condition, some kind of health problem, or they've developed it over time because of inattention to the nuances of how they're different from everybody else and what their possible weak points are. And so it's developed into a chronic exhaustion or something like that. And people have to sort of face the idea that their life has changed and that they need to change their behaviors and sort of grapple with this. And that stages of change very much apply to that as well.
Right. It's a process, you know, is over time. And And then motivational interviewing kind of grew up around the same time by a guy called Bill Miller, another guy, you know, would be great for your show. He's at the University of New Mexico, a psychologist. And it basically formalized steps in how you work with people. And you have to understand at what stage they're at before you start to work with people. So, classic example, when I was a case manager working with the homeless mentally ill, kind of before these models, I knew about these models, and they were really just being articulated, that what you would say to someone using substances is go to AA or NA. And the first step of those 12-step programs is, you know, writing all the problems that your addiction has caused and writing an inventory. Now, that has to mean that you accept the illness or the addiction or the problem. Most of the people that I was dealing with at the time were in the so-called pre-contemplation stage. They weren't really aware that they had a problem, or they were, you know, as we say, in denial, which is one of those therapeutic phrases that I hate.
Or they're blaming other people.
Or blaming other people, exactly. And so to send them to an intervention that requires an acceptance of the illness is just not going to do anybody any good. And so what you would do with someone in the pre-contemplation phase is just slowly engage them, thank them for, you know, talking to you, perhaps give them a little bit of literature on, you know, on schizophrenia or substance abuse or whatever, and then meet them where they're at. And so motivational interviewing is very formal techniques. One of them, for example, is develop discrepancy. So what you'll find with folks in those early stages of change is they'll say they want to do something, but then their actions, of course, are different. And rather than telling them what they should do, you use their own words and you say, look, and you don't do it without, you do it without judgment. You just say, you know, I remember you telling me the first time that we met, you know, you wanted to get clean for your daughter. And then I noticed you came in and you said that you had just used last night. What's the discrepancy between what you said and what you did? And there may be, and hopefully is, and the evidence base for motivational interviewing is very, very strong, an insight-building process. And it's a process of engaging people's own internal motivation to change rather than imposing something. And you see it now in medicine, even mainstream medicine, you know, much more of listening and understanding. My wife had to go to the ER and a year ago for something relatively minor, but the literature sheet that she got from the ER was, you are the most important person in your recovery. And that's, you know, motivational interviewing in one word. As far as peer engagement, that's something
before
that
you go on, I'd like to comment.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I sort of get carried away.
Well, there's two of us here, so it's okay. You're saying wonderful things, and I want people to hear you, but I just have a couple of quick comments.
Absolutely.
One is that on the motivational interviewing, I found this part of your book remarkably helpful because I find myself in my own practice at my best doing that.
Mm-hmm.
when I'm able to. That's kind of what I did, and so it really affirmed something that I was feeling anyway, which is that people generally know what's going on with themselves. They actually
right.
have a lot of insight, and one of the tricks in my job is to sit with them and to allow that to come forward. And but like I said, when I'm doing my job correctly, what I try to do is see what they are able to do or want to do, because one of the things about behaviors is that people are doing the best they can at taking care of themselves, and sometimes these behaviors are perverse, but they're still trying to take care of themselves and trying to feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to knock the blocks out from under somebody. You want to see if, as Jeffrey has said, letting go of one behavior, you can concentrate not on losing something, but on gaining something else.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that part of your book where you discuss these therapies remarkably helpful, because it really clarifies a way of thinking about people-centered or allowing people, giving room for people, making room for people to have the fullness of who they are and to be able to make their own decisions instead of relying so heavily on experts and hierarchical stuff. And you know what? We need to take a short break. Is that okay?
Yes, absolutely.
So we'll just take a brief break. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm on the phone with Charles Barber. His book is Comfortably Numb, and it is a pantheon book. We're going to listen to a little bit of music and then we'll come back to this interview. I'm here with Jeff Fawcett and I'm Lena Berman. Stay with us.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all, my empire of dirt.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman in studio with Jeff Fawcett and on the phone with Charles Barber, author of Comfortably Numb. That was, of course, Johnny Cash from his last album, a very chilling song called Hurt. There is information about our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772, and there's also information at sustainablehealthinstitute.org. I'll be doing a week-long workshop Saturday, July 26th at the Point Reyes Dance Palace with Ed Brown, author of the Tassajara Bread Book, Tassajara Cooking, and subject of the film How to Cook Your Life. The workshop is called Health from the Ground Up, and there is information on our website at yourownhealthandfitness.org or at our information number 707-874-2772. So we're talking about these therapeutic approaches, and you're about to talk about peer engagement, I believe.
Something that you had said that, you know, the patient or the client or the recipient of care is really the expert in their own recovery. And one of the great things about motivational interviewing is you find when you're a practitioner of various kinds, and I was a case manager and then running programs, that when you work harder than your clients on their issues, it's always a red flag. And the great thing about motivational interviewing is it's entirely person-centered and taking the lead from the client, and ultimately they are in charge, you know? And so it's this wonderful, you know, as a practitioner, you don't get frustrated because it's really up to them. And then the practitioner or the doctor or the psychiatrist is really kind of an expert consultant. So the idea is from like Home Depot, you can do it, we can help, is sort of the model. In terms of the peer engagement, this is stuff that I've done research on at Yale, and it's just another way of working with people with mental illness that, again, there's a very strong research base, which is essentially hiring people with, say, schizophrenia who are now doing really well and are stable in their illness and have insight and understanding, and then hiring them and having them work with people who are doing less well, who might be living under bridges or really actively symptomatic or using substances. And the research that we did in New Haven and elsewhere in Connecticut is that there's these things called ACT teams, which are kind of roving teams of psychiatrists and social workers who try and engage people living under bridges and people with mental illness. And we added a peer, someone who had a severe illness who was now stable, to these teams. And it was a random clinical trial, so randomized clinical trial. So half the teams had this peer and half of them didn't. And we found that the ones that had the peer added, the recipients of the care had much more contact with the teams, had much greater measures of feeling understood by the teams, and they also had some real solid measurements like more AA and NA group attendance. And it was a fairly brief, fairly small study, but I'm quite sure that if we followed it longer term, we'd see more engagement into medical treatment, into housing, into other kinds of services, and reduced hospitalizations. And so, you know, people listen to people who have been there. It's not rocket science. You know, a lot of healthcare is not rocket science.
Thank you.
I'm sorry?
Thank you. I agree with you.
Yeah. And
I mean, I actually think that, you know, when you said that this kind of work is not frustrating, I think it is to an extent that people will come to see me, for instance, and maybe in the same way, someone like you, and say, I'm coming to you because you're not a psychiatrist or you're not a physician, and because I want to be, you know, I want to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to educate them, and they are so used to hierarchical treatment that they can't quite let go of the idea that you're going to tell them what to do, and they keep trying to get you to just tell them what to do and to be a doctor or to be a psychiatrist or something. And it's hard to retrain people to let go of the idea that someone else is going to pull you off the sort of precipice, that it's that someone can say you're at the precipice. If you turn around, we can discuss some other ways of doing this, or even just that you're approaching a precipice. Any of this to try to get them to sort of take charge or be present, to suddenly become embodied and be present in the midst of their lives is very difficult, I find, because of our culture.
Right, right. And what's happened in the mental health field is that there's been some wonderfully progressive work. A woman called Mary Beth Copeland, who's in Vermont, who suffers from bipolar disorder, was told that she wasn't going to work, wasn't going to recover, essentially. Has done remarkably well, published many books, and then is the inventor of something called the WRAP plan, which is the Wellness Recovery Action Plan, which is essentially a guided, having the patient guide the treatment. Part of it is acknowledging that there are times with mental illness, which is waxes and wanes, and with psychotic illnesses, there are periods of psychosis. This isn't part of the WRAP plan, I don't believe, but there's been a movement to have people create treatment plans legally when they're psychotic. And so when they're of sound mind, making those treatment decisions before they go into some
right.
sort of an episode.
Right, having people sort of in line to help them with stuff and things.
Exactly.
Like that.
And so I've just seen, you know, wonderful, wonderful things with people that, you know, we think of, society thinks of as enormously impaired, that when you sort of change the tables and you put them in charge, and, you know, I've been involved, I've also worked with people with criminal issues and backgrounds, and when you engage them in pro-social activities, when you have them do volunteer work and they pick up the park or something like that, that it changes the whole table, it changes the whole, you know, the whole way of looking at things. And again, with these incredibly severe illnesses, I've seen some, you know, really wonderful recovery. And so the impetus for Comfortably Numb is, okay, the meds can be, you know, very effective, I've found, for many people with severe psychiatric illnesses. The issues are when you start using these medications for people with, you know, what are essentially life problems. And then what I found was that the social context of recovery was critical for even these horrifically biological illnesses. I mean, there's no way you hang out with someone with schizophrenia and you don't know that it's a disease of the brain. But even within that context, how you approach people, how you work with them, and just a lot of just humanity, essentially. I found, I'm not a terribly formal medical person, as you can tell, but at one point, I would actually call clients I'd say Mr. Gray or Mr. Stevenson or something. And I found that was actually effective because nobody would treat them, you know, with respect. So for a while I would do that sort of thing. And, you know, so it's just interesting seeing, what can make a difference with people.
Since your approach prefers, understandably, to veer away from the theory that biological imbalances trigger symptoms. I understand that. But I do want to just mention a few circumstances where biology might be an underpinning, but not in the usual way of thinking that the brain is, that you've got a serotonin deficiency or something, because that's very hard to track. There's so many receptors for serotonin. It's so complex, and it interacts with so many other things that to pinpoint things like that.
Oh, it's incredibly. I write about that in the book.
It's just a mess.
That's just so simplistic.
It's a mess.
It's like
yeah.
a cartoon version.
Right. Right. It's simplistic. But as I've said in shows that I've done on depression, you always want to check the thyroid first, because low thyroid is just this so simple to fix. I mean, it's so easy to fix, and the thyroid hormone that you use is bioidentical. It matches what the body makes. So easy to do, and low thyroid is just a huge reason for depression.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other hormone imbalances, like men with low testosterone, which is increasingly becoming a problem because of all the xenoestrogens in the environment and because of our diet and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It causes men to lose their emotional affect. They become disimpassioned. They become withdrawn and angry and irritable, much different than you would expect low testosterone people to be. But there it is, and that can be remarkable. Women with imbalances of their hormones, which is another rampant problem when they're very mildly, very delicately rebalanced with bioidentical hormones through the skin, very, very low doses that most doctors wouldn't even consider worth taking. And then there's all the brilliant early work of Abram Hoffer, who is one of the pioneers of orthomolecular medicine, was a peer of Linus Pauling, sort of encouraged Linus Pauling, treated schizophrenics with niacin and reversed their condition with just niacin, which points to the relationship between circulatory issues and family lines and nutrient problems that are caused by DNA variants that run in families. So now we find that the folic acid, B12, B6, the methylation pathways can lead to, which affect circulation, also lead to terrible psychiatric symptoms. And then, so all these nutrient deficiencies. And then there's also, as you're just telling about this bipolar woman, there was a psychiatric nurse who became a psychiatric nurse because she was schizophrenic. And she managed to get her hands on an early book describing the use of omega-3 fish oils for treating schizophrenia. She took them and reversed her symptoms just using that. And although you do want to take a little extra vitamin E. But the thing that was interesting was that it required, a very specific amount. Like somebody would take maybe 10,000 milligrams of fish oils, and they would have their symptoms stop. But if they went down to 9, it would come back. So people, it's very dose dependent, and it requires some support and help to find the right combinations of things. But there are remarkable things, and the literature goes back to very early, to the 50s and stuff before psychiatric meds. I also might mention or remind people that psychiatric meds were developed as a byproduct of industry, of chemical industry. They had produced an indigo blue dye, and they were kind of thinking, what else can we do with this? And they gave it to some controls, and they discovered that it caused a chemical lobotomy. It lobotomized them. I mean, it made them extremely passive. So it started being used in psychiatric hospitals, and that was the birth of psychiatric meds. So that's just to remember that, as Abram Hoffer said when I interviewed him so many years ago, he's quite elderly, no one has ever suffered from a deficiency of psychiatric meds. So just a little.
I have seen the fish oil be wonderfully important for depression. And one of the, we were talking about Japan earlier and the low rates of depression.
Yes.
Certainly there's cultural reasons for that. But also they eat a lot of fish in Japan.
They did.
Supplies something that the brain needs. So I absolutely agree with that. One of the more striking conversations I had, I spoke to many, many neuroscientists, and I had this sort of impression that they were all marching forward in their white coats towards truth, and it was all sort of figuring it out, and again, a very linear, clean process. And I found that they would all sort of attack each other's work.
It's very reductionistic.
Yes, yes. And I spoke to a guy who's now retired who I think as a result was speaking more freely. But he said, I said, why do all the psych drugs basically deal with four or so neurotransmitters, dopamine and serotonin being the most well-known. Is that because those neurotransmitters are the ones understood to be the most involved in, you know, mood and thought dysregulation? And he said, no, absolutely not. You know, there's essentially probably 100 neurotransmitters. And the first drugs, as you say, were found totally by serendipity. They didn't know how they worked whatsoever. And then in the 60s, they kind of caught up and they traced them to these neurotransmitters. And then since then, basically, all drugs have been copycat versions of the, in the same paradigm as those originals. So potentially there's 90 other neurotransmitters that could have, you know, better or different implications.
And neurotransmitters are, in fact, anything that communicates with your cells. So all your amino acids,
mm-hmm.
and this is just a kind of a warning to people who are being strict vegans, that you need all of your amino acids, and especially sulfur-containing ones, which unfortunately appear mostly in animal products, although it can be eggs and milk, too. The sulfur-containing aminos and the amino acids are the raw material for these neurotransmitters, as are your hormones are also or neurotransmitters, anything that communicates with the cells. And so diet is very important in all of this.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, very quickly, again, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. Lena Berman here with Charles Barber, B-A-R-B-E-R, as it sounds. Comfortably Numb is his book. These styles of stages of change, motivational interviewing, etc. There have been, Courtney Harding did some studies in Vermont and Maine, and they followed up and discovered remarkable things about how they work. I mean, I can abbreviate this by just saying they work, you know. But then it brings up this question of how do people find places where they can find this kind of stuff? Where can they get in touch with people doing this kind of work?
Well, there's a motivational interviewing website. I think it's motivationalinterviewing.org. The number of people that are trained in this technique is growing. I think there's hundreds of research studies. All that stuff is on the website. It's really something that has grown, and you kind of can sense that some of these things are going towards a tipping point. So my brother is a medical director of a hospital in Massachusetts, and when I was learning about all this stuff, I thought it was pretty much confined to, you know, addiction and mental health, and I told him about it with great excitement. He said, oh, yeah, you know, I've been to trainings on that, and certainly the more progressive, you know, again, it definitely has to be progressive. And younger people are in internists and internal medicine. I spoke to a guy who runs the internal medicine department at NYU, and he said that his first and central mission for the first couple of years of his tenure was to expose his doctors to these models, because they are prevention models as well. So there's a sense that this stuff is taking off. There's no money to be made in it. There's no product, unlike, you know, the drugs. Also, the people that are into this kind of stuff are not, you know, the best people at marketing it. You can get, you know, motivational interviewing manuals from SAMHSA, which is the Federal Mental Health and Substance Abuse Administration, for free, you know. But I think, and I also think that there's been a tremendous interest in my book that's actually kind of surprised me. And there's been a number of books around the same time that sort of question the over-medicalization, the over-drugging, and are looking at sort of more subtle ways of looking, more philosophical ways of looking at happiness and change and so on. And so one of them is called On Sadness. And I think that there's sort of a hunger and a thirst for a more organic, more spiritual way, spiritual in just a broad sense, more holistic way of looking at these things in psychiatry and mental health. You know, it's still on the margins, but it's much less on the margins than it was when I, you know, even 10 years ago.
Well, one of the things also, of course, is that health insurance, which is becoming less and less available to people, pays for psychiatric medications if you have a diagnosis,
yeah.
But it does not pay for some of these other therapies. And this is distinct from other countries, like Britain has, you know, just everywhere. Actually, if you look at Scandinavia, too, it's amazing how well they take care of people. I mean, they don't stigmatize people of any kind, whether it's whether they're having uncomfortable mental symptoms or they're having some kind of other disability that makes it challenging them, even including people who are like chemically sensitive or electrosensitive. They're treated with compassion as somebody that has something extra to deal with and needs extra help. It's so different from the edgy kind of, you know, pull your socks up kind of attitude of the U.S. and the lack of funding for people.
Right, and in Britain, just recently, they've invested huge amounts of money in new psychiatric, psychological clinics specializing in cognitive behavioral therapy, which is another therapy that I write about in the book that has very good outcomes for milder to moderate depression. And there's clinical guidelines from the National Health Service in Britain for milder to moderate depression, which counsel all the things that we've been talking about. One of them, actually, the first one, just being watchful waiting, because some things just, you know, clear up. But diet and exercise and self-help and counseling and then cognitive behavioral therapy. And then if those things don't work, then to go to antidepressants. In the U.S., our practice is exactly the opposite. You know, it's if the antidepressants don't work, then you look for other things. And so, as you say, it's a very American, sort of rooted in you know, cultural things, and specifically I write in the book about sort of this pressure to be happy that we feel like we're so under that I think is actually very destructive.
There's also an intolerance for weakness in this country.
Yes, yes. And I finished the book with Walker Percy, who was a Catholic novelist who suffered from depression and wrote very knowledgeably from the heart about this sort of stuff. And he actually talked about, I thought of him when you were talking earlier about he said we live in an age of experts, and we see different parts of our body to different experts. And I think what, in the context of what we're talking about, the pill is sort of the ultimate expert, you know, that the pill is really going to take care of it for us. And he also wrote that, you know, for milder forms of depression or just sadness or life difficulties, the question should be not what's wrong with you, but what's right with you. And, you know, we should turn it on its head. The typical thing, in the American grain, what's wrong? And, you know, maybe it's perfectly appropriate to be sad and bummed out and angry and traumatized, particularly, you know, I would argue by, you know, events in recent years in this country. And, you know, it's sort of time to look at those things. This is not to, romanticize suffering. This is not to, denigrate treatment for severe disorders. But, you know, we don't need to be so quick to run to the prescription pad for, you know, life issues.
Well, you know, there's a whole school of thought, too, and I talk about this a lot, that the way that you get to a yes or to an understanding of what to do is often by understanding the no part first. So for many people, understanding what they cannot do because they don't feel comfortable, because things make them feel worse or causes symptoms or whatever it is, whatever you find are what you would view as your negative, doesn't work well with others, you know, not a team player as well. So maybe you're somebody who really has to work alone and works best alone and really needs that, or whatever it is, you know, the various negatives, you know, oversensitive, this or that, you know, actually is pointing to a better path for you where you can excel. And sometimes grasping and embracing the negatives gives you clues on what to do.
Right. And in mental health symptoms, can be used adaptively. I have suffered from obsessive compulsive disorder. That's largely what my first book, Songs from the Black Chair, is about. And it's very much under control for a lot of the social reasons that we've just been talking about. And I now use my obsessive tendencies, you know, rather effectively by, you know, there's 450 footnotes in Comfortably Numb, and I obsessively, you know, researched it. And so there's a flip side, within reason, because there's nothing good about pure psychosis or pure mania or pure depression.
Not if you're making yourself very unhappy with it, yes. But being being very perfectionistic can be a gift.
Right, and I would argue that for most psychiatric diagnoses, you can. There's a flip side in a, of being able to use them adaptively, but that often takes a great deal of a huge, long process of personal discovery, mm-hmm. Which is yet another, the sort of images from the drug ads of this quick fix. And the reality is, when you talk to people that have gotten better from severe mental illness, it's a decades-long process of acceptance and recovery. And so it takes time.
Folic acid and B12 are really important for OCD. Just to add that. I have one last question for you. Since so many drugs are targeted at kids, what are we teaching children about drug use?
Well, I think there, and I write about this a whole lot in the book, is the television advertising of drugs, which just popped up in the mid to late 1990s in this country. There was a change in regs that allowed it to happen, and New Zealand and the United States are the only countries in the world that allow TV advertising of drugs. And what we've seen is, among young people, basically a decrease in the abuse of illicit drugs and a soaring rise in the abuse of prescription drugs. And I think that these TV ads are a huge part of that, because, you know, if you're 15 years old, you grew up on these ads. You've never seen anything different, and they're omnipresent now on TV. And they've turned these drugs into commodities, and, you know, they're advertised next to toothpaste and Coca-Cola, and, you know, they're meant to seem exactly like toothpaste and Coca-Cola, and they're just sort of tossed around and traded around, and that's what we're seeing with college students, and, you know, snorting Ritalin before they, you know, to study for the midterm, and that's endemic among young people, and that can be a tragic situation.
You were listening to an interview with Charles Barber, and his book is Comfortably Numb, How Psychiatry is Medicating a Nation. I want to remind you that I'll be doing a day-long workshop Saturday, July 26th, at the Point Reyes Dance Palace with Ed Brown, author of the Tassajara Bread book, Tassajara Cooking, and subject to the film How to Cook Your Life. The workshop is called Health from the Ground Up. There's information on our website, or you can call 707-874-2772. Again, thank you for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, and lots more, yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number again is 707-874-2772, and there's also information at sustainablehealthinstitute.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.